My name is Jane Rossing, and this session is called Even the Perrier is Contaminated. Will there be enough clean water for all? As we all know, water is without any doubt our most important natural resource. Life evolved in water. We need water constantly in order to grow, in order for all life to take place. And so as the Scientific American that I was reading said, one might therefore suppose that human beings would be respectful of water. But I think we're all aware that more and more we fail to be as respectful as we need to be of our marvelous sources of water. As many of you know, I've just returned from 5.5 years in Africa, in Senegal, in West Africa. And as you may know, this whole area here is the Sahara Desert, and the area just south of it is known as the Sahel, the semi-desert, very arid area, but where hundreds of millions of people live. And that's what got my interest started in water problems. I come from Minnesota, where water is plentiful, as I'm sure many of you come from places that we don't have to really worry about quantity of water. The two things that I'm going to be talking about this afternoon are both quantity of water, which some areas of our country and some areas of the world are tremendously worried about, and then what all of us need to worry about is quality of water, no matter how much water we have. So, as I said, I got interested as I lived in this very dry area, and one of the main things that took especially women and some children many hours a day, up to 4 hours some women were spending on getting water for their family. Many people lived up to 5 miles away from the nearest source of water at all, of any quality. And for a shorter distance, obviously women carry water in huge basins on their head. They loaded it on donkeys, they carried it on carts, and many different forms of transport were found. But it really made me realize deep inside how water determines our lives. Where people can settle is determined by water, and certainly the quality of our lives. In 1980, the United Nations declared this last decade that we're just finishing up the International Drinking Water Supply and Sanitation Decade. Mm-hmm. Now, it might not be something that we all heard of a lot of in this country, but it's one of the UN decade. It was very important to us working in international development. The goal, which they set in 1980, and which, of course, we did not meet, was a clean source of water for all people in the world by the year 1990. We made a little progress, obviously not nearly enough. But it really brought home to governments and to international agencies how very difficult it is to assure a safe source of water for everyone in the world. The area that we think about the most is, of course, our own consumption, the consumption by people. But as you probably know also, this represents a very small quantity of the water that's used. Now, water, of course, is not used up. We talk about how many gallons are used flushing our toilets, how many hundreds of or thousands of acre feet are used to irrigate in a certain place. But the water, of course, there's the same amount of water if you look at the whole world. It can't disappear, it can't cease to exist. But what happens to it? If you think about it, you certainly all know this. It evaporates into the atmosphere, and then, of course, it's not where we want it anymore. That's one of the main things that happens to our water, especially with agriculture. It's still there in the hydrologic system as a whole, but it's moved to a place where it's no longer useful. Or especially what happens to it is that it goes down in quality. It's no longer of that high quality that we need for whatever use we have, drinking, agriculture, or whatever. But in talking about quantity, obviously the place that hits me the most is Africa. I think about that a lot more. But I wanted to start with a place that many of you probably know a lot more about. and is much closer to home. And then that helps us to get in focus these whole issues. And that's in California. Even if you don't live there, a tremendous amount has been written about it. And I'm sure you've read some, just like I have. I don't know really this issue firsthand, except in sort of indirect ways. As California now, in 1990, faces its fourth consecutive dry season, it seems to be all the talk. All the national magazines, and I'm sure the local thing, press, is writing constantly about what to do about this drought. The Los Angeles mayor, Tom Bradley, has proposed a system where households must reduce their consumption to levels 10% below the 1986 level. According to the latest things I read, this hasn't gone into effect because people will always resist when there isn't actually a water shortage yet. But what we need to think about and what we all need to learn to think about more is the fact that there will be a water shortage. Even if there's enough this year, there isn't enough for next year. So California is going to have to think hard about how to assure its amount of water in the future. Since 1941, well, let me just ask, is anyone here from California? You may know more about this than you are, just one. All right, so the rest of us are either Midwest or maybe the Northwest where there's also more water.
In the last couple of weeks, in case you missed it, somebody over there made a proposal, which has been made before, from California. Mm-hmm. Well, let's tap the Columbia River.
Yes.
Okay, I read that. I'm sure that Seattle will be really excited about that.
Yeah.
And anybody who flies over California and sees all those swimming pools, just has no
I'm from Northern California.
They're taking our water, too.
That's right.
Well, they've already tapped the Colorado River. Oh, it's practically dry by the time it hits its mouth.
That's exactly right. Southern California has drawn out tremendous amounts out of the Colorado River. In 1941, it seems that the pipeline was built, the aqueduct from the Colorado River over to Los Angeles. And since then, they have been drawing out about 1.2 million acre feet a year. Now, that seems to be the unit that's used for enormous amounts of water. It's of course the amount of water that it takes to cover an acre of land to the height of 1 foot. And 1 acre foot can support about 2 families, 2 households for a year, seems to be roughly the calculation. So they've been drawing everything they're capable of pumping out of the Colorado River since they built this aqueduct. But I think it was last year or a few years ago that the federal courts decided that other states besides California had the right to that water, especially Arizona. And those states are going to start drawing on their water rights. One of the places I thought of going to graduate school, and now I'm really glad I didn't, the more I learned about it, was the University of Arizona. And there I would have worked on a PhD in irrigation engineering. And when I was down there visiting, of course, all the engineers seemed to be telling me that, oh, you know, it's going to be big in Arizona. We've just got all this new water. The future is in irrigation. It's fantastic. This is a great time to work on it. But when we think on a scale of what really is the right thing to do in our country and where really we need agriculture, of course it's not in Arizona and it's not in Southern California. So now Los Angeles can draw no more than 550,000 acre feet of a year. That's a tremendous drop for them, and they're trying to figure out how to replace that water. At the same time, it seems that the California courts decided that they needed to reduce the water from the Owens Valley, mainly because the fish and wildlife are being threatened. And we hear a lot about that. That's a victory for environmentalists. So what's Southern California going to do? On top of all these shortages, the population is growing at a rate of about 3 million every 10 years. That's how it's stated. It continues to grow. Recently, I heard a report on National Public Radio, and when they were talking about these shortages, they interviewed one person who was very angry at California for not somehow getting more water in. They said they're using water limitation as a way of controlling growth, and that's really wrong. And most of us, I think, in this room might say, well, you know, what's wrong about that? Of course they need to use water limits is a limit to growth. It's very real. We can't avoid it, no matter how rich we are. All right, what's all the water used for? swimming pools was raised up as one use that's perhaps not the most important. What's your perception?
Irrigation.
Yeah, okay, we all know that. In California, only 9% of the water is for city dwellers. Industry uses about 6%, which leaves 85% of the water use in California for agriculture. And as you probably know also, because of Bureau of Reclamation projects all throughout this century, farmers pay the very low rate of only about $5 to $10 in different places per acre foot, whereas the city dwellers are paying up to $250 per acre foot. So, lots of solutions, lots of people are talking about it. I think this problem is certainly well known, but solutions are less clear. Agriculture perhaps in California is not that important, but across the board it's not so easy to condemn agriculture as perhaps we have the tendency to do with big industry that's polluting our water or something like that. We do need food. One of the, perhaps long scale, but something that is being done in California is that Los Angeles has made a deal with the farmers in the Imperial Valley in which they will pay, the Los Angeles City will pay for improvements in irrigation efficiency in return for the use of the water that's saved. And Los Angeles has figured that this is more cost effective, even paying for all these, what essentially helps the farmers' irrigation systems. This is cheaper for them than developing any new source of water. They're figuring this costs about $128 per acre foot, whereas any new system they could come up with costs well over $200. Mm-hmm. So irrigation efficiency, of course, is something that we're all for. Nobody can be against it. But the problem is it's expensive, and it has to be in farmers' interests to improve it. So they will line canals with concrete, canals that are presently simply earth-lined, improve valves, and whatever other measures they find are cost-effective. So water quantity limitations are something that's close to home. It's not only far away in drought, desert areas. But internationally, water is perhaps more threatening. And one of the things that people are writing a lot about now are the possibility of water wars. As a matter of fact, Egypt's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, quoted in World Watch magazine, said, he's talking about the Middle East, this is not a peaceful area. The next war in our region will be over the waters of the Nile, not politics. Which is it's a very scary proposition. Because of course, we talk about oil, wars for oil, possibility, but we can live without oil, but nobody can live without water. So, on my map here, well, I guess it's too small as you get into the Middle East, but two of the main rivers that countries could very easily fight over are the Jordan, which, of course, Israel, Jordan, and is it Syria all have to share and figure out ways to share. And then Egypt's talking about the Nile. And when we think of the Nile, we usually think of Egypt. But all the water of the Nile comes from outside Egypt. There's almost no precipitation at all in this whole basin. Everything comes from Sudan and areas further on. One of the Nile starts in Uganda and the other in Ethiopia. And it seems that Egypt has a good agreement with Sudan to let a certain amount of water pass from Sudan into Egypt. But there's very real possibility that Ethiopia could start using a lot more of its possible irrigation potential. And that would block water into Sudan, and they would have to block water into Egypt. And it could become a very tense political situation. Of course, the hot spot of the Middle East is Israel. And right now, Israel's agriculture is about 65% irrigated. So they're very, very heavily dependent on irrigated agriculture. Although not as heavily dependent as Egypt, whose agriculture is 100% irrigated. But it seems that Israel already uses 95% of the renewable supplies available to it. They've increased 6 times, sixfold increase since 1948. I think most of us, when we think of Israeli agriculture, we think of efficient irrigations. The new drip irrigation systems were developed for the most part there. They've really been leaders and in various ways of conserving water. The Israelis are not wasting a great deal of water in the sense that inefficient irrigation systems with earth-lined canals, not level fields, which waste a lot of water and things like that. The Israelis are among the most efficient in the world, but there simply is no way that they can increase their amount of irrigated land with the amount of water that they're using. So it seems like it will inevitably lead to more conflict than there is already. For groundwater, they depend on an aquifer that's recharged in the Arab countries, especially in the West Bank. So as the Christian Science Monitor, I wrote this down as a quote, says, this is in the Christian Science Monitor, a very reputable paper, keeping Tel Aviv and the other cities of the Israeli coastal plain, plus of course Israeli agriculture, from running dry depends on blocking Arab water development in the West Bank that could stop the aquifer's flow westward. Aquifers, we know, have to run into the ocean in order to keep them fresh. If they're drawn down too far, if there's too high of a water use in an aquifer of our underground water, the seawater will start flowing in, and that's how we get salty water. Aquifers, for the most part, especially near an ocean, won't run, well, aquifers near an ocean, we'll say, won't run dry. They'll simply get salty, and a salty aquifer we can't use. So the aquifer is running east from the West Bank across Israel and into the ocean. And obviously Israel is very concerned about keeping that supply up. And as we know, the relationships between countries there make it very difficult for this to remain through peaceful cooperation. If even California and Arizona can't agree over water use, obviously countries that are already under tension, it's going to increase. Now I want to tell you a little about the area that I know best, which is here, Senegal. And a few of you were here when I talked about the refugees from Mauritania, the political problems between Senegal, little Senegal, it's not a big country, and Mauritania, this large country to the north, which is mostly desert. This is a very infertile country with very little water supply. All this area is semi-desert, but there's a major river that's fed in this sort of rainforest area, a really rainy place, the country of Guinea, and it flows north and out, and this is the Senegal River. And the Senegal River is an enormous river, and it has, of course, a lot of potential. When people who are concerned about hungry people, I don't want to paint policymakers in a negative fashion. I think this has come out of real concern for increasing food supply to hungry people. When you see that kind of water in that water-hungry area, you think how to develop it. How can that water better serve the needs of the people? And let me just read this. A 12th century king of Sri Lanka set the ultimate standard for water engineers when he said, "Let not even a small quantity of water obtained by rain go to the sea without benefiting man." And in a sense, I think that's a moral position. For me, it is very important that people have enough food. So when we see water that could potentially irrigate flow out to the ocean does not need the water. That's clear. The ocean has plenty of water. So the general feeling is that we want to use all that water before it gets to the ocean. A country like China is doing really still working towards that goal. I mean, they're using up phenomenal amounts of their water, which is not bad if many other conditions are considered along the way. So the problem, as in, we know state borders, also national borders, is that the Senegal River forms a boundary between two countries. Matter of fact, between three. this is Mali, this is Senegal, and this is Mauritania, and this is Guinea, where it starts. So these countries, in order to develop the Senegal River, got together and formed what's called the Organization for the Development of the Senegal River Basin, basically, if I translate it into English. And people were very excited about it. I've read about it many times, even is in the World Watch State of the World papers, as an exciting example of international cooperation. These countries really have gotten together over about 25 years and planned how they're going to split up the water, and in the end they built two dams on the river to make the water supply more equal throughout the year and to block the salt water from coming back up the river. You see, where I live is very flat. If you've seen some of my slides, or maybe if you see the video afterwards, it's very, very flat. A river flows from us down to the ocean, which is about 200 miles away, but it falls just a few feet in doing that. It's a very, very flat area. So if the level of fresh water in the river falls, salt water comes out of the ocean and goes up the river. And so that, of course, is useless for agriculture. So these countries got together and built one dam to block the salt water from coming up, and another dam way upstream to make the water supply more equal throughout the year. The dams were finished about 2 years ago, the last one. So this was very interesting to me, because everybody was talking, oh, this is going to be our salvation, you know, the dams are going to increase irrigation and we'll all have enough to eat, and etc. Well, of course, they did nothing of the sort. All they can do is regulate the water supply, and the irrigation still has to happen. But then, the other thing that happened in May of 1989 is that Mauritania and Senegal almost went to war. They were very close to it and remained sort of on the verge of it. And as we know, this is far too common in world politics. Now this organization, which was set up 25 years ago and has its base in Dakar, Senegal, is totally dysfunctional, because anyone from Mauritania refuses to come to Dakar. They will not set foot in the country. And it's been suggested that the head of the agency, where the office is, moved to Mali or some other neutral country, but that creates a lot of other difficulties, because they do have an infrastructure that's been built up over the years, you know, computer facilities, all the planning, the libraries, and it's a very major institution that's been worked on. Now the countries cannot talk to each other, and the whole project is perhaps not in great danger, but is not nearly living up to its potential. And these are the kinds of things that happen. Many people have raised the issue that this is a typical situation that happens when dams are built. As everything changes about people's tradition, and it's something that we often have not thought about. Large dams have a very bad name now, certainly in Africa and in most of the world, because they simply have too many unforeseen consequences. And in a sense, this semi-war is one of the unforeseen consequences of this dam. As everything changes, land value goes up. Suddenly people that had no traditional rights to the irrigated land along the edge want that land. And that's a lot of the problem. So that's a situation that's very close to me.
Is the Senegal River clear and drinkable, or is it full of mud?
Yeah, it's full of mud part of the year when the runoff comes. We have a very short rainy season. In areas like this, I mean, we might have 3 months of rain would be the maximum in a year. The other 9 months would be completely dry. Sometimes it shrinks down to a couple months. But there is an annual flood that comes up, a very large annual flood, and at that point there's a lot of runoff, so the water's very murky. At the rest of the year, it's clear, but it's absolutely not drinkable, because it's the times when it's clear, so there isn't very much flow, it's almost stagnant, that the quality is the worst. The microbes just sit there. Nothing is washed away.
Are the fields enriched by the flooding?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, now I want to talk. Okay, that's surface water. Surface water is it's the thing that's the most visible to us. But of course, most of the water is not in our lakes, streams, anything else that we can see. Most of our fresh water in the world is in groundwater. So this, again, we know problems in the U.S. and there are a lot of problems in Africa. What do you think of when you think of groundwater that's being depleted in the United States? I think everybody knows what aquifer, what one aquifer that we have almost the most problem with.
Everglades.
The Everglades, now that's,
yeah.
I think that's true.
It's dying.
That's right. Because the salt water is coming in, isn't that it?
Because they've drained so much of it.
They've drained so much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Real estate development.
Uh-huh. Okay, what else do you think of with groundwater problems in the United States?
Doesn't Arizona have a problem? They're going farther and farther down to get the water?
Yeah, and I'm not sure about Arizona if some of it is being recharged. But obviously they're pumping out at much too high a rate.
Mm-hmm. One of their governors was trying to put a stop to it and did in a way control the abuses of waste of water.
Yeah, you have to get special permission in Arizona though, don't you?
Yeah, they put that law through.
Mm-hmm. Where else?
Pollution through pesticides and chemicals from farming.
Okay, that's the quality problem. That's right. Our groundwater is very much threatened by pesticides, especially. Mm-hmm.
But you're talking
Where is we really mining groundwater? Well, maybe we don't know.
Colorado?
It's
through Nebraska. That's the Ogallala Aquifer, this huge aquifer of the southern Midwest, sort of, can we call it that, seems to be, from what most people are saying, now we have a geologist sitting here, I'm not sure this is right, is not being recharged at all. When we take water out of that aquifer, we are mining it. Mm-hmm. It's just like mining iron or whatever else we mine. It's not being recharged. We're taking out an aquifer, we're taking out a non-renewable natural resource. For so long we thought of water as something that just renews itself.
You know what's happened in Florida where they are draining so many of the aquifers then? As they get dry, they develop sinkholes and great big hunks of land fall in sometimes a house.
That's what I've heard.
Or a highway.
Because the water's gone.
The water's gone.
In the Midwest, it's a case of not enough rainfall?
No, it's a case of draining the aquifers.
Yeah. No, I mean in the Middle West.
That aquifer, do you know when the Ogallala was formed? I mean, it must be prehistoric in some way. Because they say it really is not being recharged or at a very small rate. So when farmers started irrigating in Nebraska, Oklahoma, all those fairly dry states where a little bit can be grown, crops like sorghum can be grown with just rain. But obviously production goes up tremendously if you irrigate, and you can grow anything. Wheat is a big one. But they're pumping out. Well, since the aquifer has been falling, pumping becomes more and more expensive. You can pump onto your land from a few hundred feet, but if you have to go down to 1,000 feet, then it's much less economical. Yeah. That's what's happened in those states. Yeah.
I was raised in Nebraska, which is the upper portion of it. And I heard many of these stories and I had these concerns, though I visited there 2 years ago where I was raised, and I expected to hear that the groundwater had fallen 10 or 15 feet, but that's not true. It's down a couple feet. Mm-hmm. Now maybe it's happening.
Are people irrigating there?
Not as much as they used to. The tax advantage has been changed to some degree. When it first happened, many out of town, out of country people were investing in land and putting down wells, and now we're seeing them sitting there unused.
Maybe there is
a hopeful trend. However, I don't know what happens to that aquifer through Kansas as it goes south.
Yeah.
There might be a much worse problem there.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think it's woken up many people to the fact that we can't put wells down wherever we want. If we have the technology, that doesn't mean we have the water to do it. Because that's what I hear. I mean, I really haven't been there at all, but I read about these wells that have been drilled at tremendous cost and are just sitting there.
I guess the proof of the pudding is on the ranch I was raised. There were two places where you get artesian wells that flowed by themselves, and they were still flowing.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. But that probably wouldn't be from the Ogallala then, because that's much deeper. That would be an aquifer much closer
perhaps
to the surface, I think.
They're about 78 feet or 80 feet.
Mm-hmm. I think the Ogallala is a lot deeper.
Is anybody trying to find out how or why the water isn't being replaced? So
well, okay, the area,
there
let me...
Is a way of, there is a source of replenishment. Is anybody trying to find out where it would be?
Well, it's not necessary that it is. Let me tell you...
The Osage River is being pumped dry.
Where's that?
They're having arguments about that. That's the river that flows into the Missouri. They've been fiddling around with the Missouri up in Dakota, too.
Well, a river has to come from somewhere. The groundwater, and the situation I know better, is this, an aquifer called the Maestrichtian Aquifer that underlies most of Senegal and going up into Mauritania. And I've just done a lot of reading because I've lived there for 5.5 years, and I think that we're all, and talking to the people who are studying it, I think we all study more where we live, so that's why I'm not real great in the Nebraska, that aquifer, although I read about it. With the Maestrichtian, there is water from about 300 feet down, and there's some. Most of the wells are being sunk to about 800 or 1,000 feet, and there's a tremendous amount of water. The first wells were drilled in the 1950s when the, of course, colonial government at that point wanted to enable herders to have their animals in areas that were completely closed. There was plenty of grass, but nobody could live there because there was no source of water whatsoever. There is simply no surface water in vast areas of Senegal. So they started drilling wells. So our records only go back about that far because it's only with drilling equipment that you can get into one of these lower aquifers. There are hand-dug wells in my area that go down from as little as 20 feet down to, say, 180 feet. There are hand-dug wells that go down that far. But that, of course, is tapping a different body of water. Now, how do we say an aquifer? Do you all know what an aquifer is? Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, it's water underground. It's not a lake. It's not a stream that flows. But in our soil, there's water between the soil particles.
And it also has to have a clay or an impervious level above it, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Below it would separate it. I mean, if there's the water that's down here isn't mixing with the water up here, but I don't know that you have to have it above it.
You don't. It's like when the rain comes down, it moves into the sediment.
Okay.
It percolates down until it fills up the pore spaces, so you can have a layer that has air in the spaces between the grains, and in the aquifer you have water that's filling up the pore spaces.
I guess I was thinking of a situation that causes an artesian well.
Right.
There
you do need to get
my Yeah, that's right. Okay, so in a place like where I was in Senegal, we've got a little bit of surface water, and that's replenished when it rains, or it's replenished from the river. So if you pull up the little bit of water that you have, which is not very much, it will eventually get regenerated. Even if there's a few drought years and it'll go down, it can go down 5 feet, 10 feet. But it will eventually probably get regenerated unless the climate changes permanently. The other aquifer, but where there's a huge amount of water, is way below that, way below. See, we're talking around 1,000 feet. And there's this huge amount of water there. But nobody can figure out where the water comes from. It's probably a result of something that changes in the, well, you know from geology that things are changing tremendously. Millions of years ago, that area could have been an ocean or could have been totally different. So the water came there at a time when the whole land formation was different. And so that's why it might be there from that time, but it's not recharging. And that's what they think in the Ogallala. The Maestrichtian, there's a possibility that it's being recharged way down to the south where we get a lot more rain and flowing north. Because there's no evidence in all the hundreds of wells that are drilled into this aquifer that they're going down. So they're not sure. They think it might be recharging. But at any rate, it's something we need to keep monitoring. But in the Ogallala aquifer, they've definitely found that when you pump water out, it doesn't seem to be replaced. And so we need to be very sensitive to that. Okay, how are we going to, it's amazing how fast this goes, how are we going to solve these water problems? What would be a rational solution for, say, the government of California to adopt to cut down on water use? Do people have some thoughts? I can give my thoughts.
Rationing, of course.
Rationing is possible in the cities. That would cut down on that little 9% that's used by the city dwellers. That's what they're doing.
I'm afraid the best way is to charge what it's worth.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that's what written more and more. I don't understand, we who are outside the area don't understand all the political problems involved in that. But that certainly seems to be the case. the amount that the farmers are paying are just minuscule by comparison to what it's worth. That's it. And somehow, politically, we're going to have to move towards a situation where the market regulates it. If farmers have to pay what the crops are, what the water is worth, they will only grow crops that really warrant that. Because the terrible situation that's going on right now, the really appalling situation, is that we're subsidizing water for people in California to grow things that we're paying people in the Midwest not to grow. As they say here, even more perverse, the Bureau of Reclamation gave farmers at least $200 million in water subsidies in 1986 to grow crops that the Department of Agriculture was paying other farmers not to grow because of surpluses.
I was surprised to find a few years ago, and this has changed recently, the city of Sacramento was charging in the city a flat amount for water usage. Mm-hmm. So people were using any amount they wanted to.
When they found that true in New York City, they don't have water meters, and they will not repeat drips or anything like that. And when there was a dry, several dry years in New York, their source of water was almost down to nothing. People were still wasting water and not replacing all this equipment that was shoddy because it didn't make any difference financially. There, it was a flat rate for a certain section of land, and if you had a 100-story building,
say
much as one story.
Is that right?
It's ridiculous.
That is really crazy. We know that we'll only conserve what we have to. Huh. Yes.
Can you give me some examples of the crops you're talking about?
Okay, one of the main ones is alfalfa. And it appears that 1/7 of the water in California agriculture is going to alfalfa and grass for livestock. And we know that the dairy industry, this was really surprising to me when I went to visit Arizona last year. The dairy industry is really moving from the Midwest to California and Arizona. That's where the heart of the milk production now is in the U.S.
That's crazy.
And we know that the Midwest is well suited for it.
Yeah, that's because they can be big farmers on the West Coast, and mm-hmm. that's the only way to survive.
Mm-hmm. Under the present situation, it's more economical to raise dairy cattle in California or Arizona with subsidized water than in the Midwest. That's and we know that, I'm sure you know, Midwest and New York dairy farmers are closing down at a very fast rate.
That's moving your supply towards your demand. Since all the people moved out there, they need it right out there in California.
Well,
I'm at
that's part of it.
That's why.
That's certainly part of it. Milk isn't a real transportable crop, but still it amazed me. I think that the California and Arizona milk is being transported around the country. But that's certainly something to bring up. Other questions that can be raised, if we're going to let the market regulate water, which seems to be the most rational course, we still need to ask a few questions. Should society protect the economies of rural areas that lose their waters to thirsty cities? Of course, cities can pay more for water than agriculture. What about rural areas that die when the water shifts? Or who protects freshwater fisheries, recreational water, and other ecologic and aesthetic values of rivers? Because that's rarely economical, mm-hmm. the amount of water that are needed for things like fish. So those are questions. I'm really resting. Do people have other comments on that? Or can we talk about quality?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, who owns the water in the agroforest? The guy that owns the land right above the water, does he own the water that's below there?
Very good question. And I'm trying to read more on it. It seems that it varies between the states. The first water rules were what we inherited from England, and that did appear to be the thing. You could do whatever you wanted with water that you could pump on your land. But of course, back in those days, it was very unlikely that somebody else was going to suffer for what you did on your land. Obviously, that policy became totally inadequate and now has been modified through some sort of clauses about responsible use. But the states differ. But the most logical solution is federal.
In the Twin Cities, the big argument now is the air conditioning. Mm-hmm. Those big buildings, because they use the water, they go down into the aquifer, pull it up and run it through the air conditioner once, and then it goes out into the sewer. And that's the big issue there as to how they can get these building owners to recycle that water rather than dumping it out so they don't use up all that water. for just that one cycle. And that was, it was talked about in the legislature, but I don't really know what happened to it. But those things get talked about for years before anything gets done, but at least that's a talk now.
Yeah, and it's something we need to keep bringing up in our political activity. For we who are from the Midwest, and where I'm going to move now, New York State, places like that, New York City, it seems, has had shortages. But many of areas in our country are in no danger whatsoever of running short on water. We've got lots of water. The problem is its quality. And let me just write down, pollution of our water comes in all different forms, just so that we think about it. I mean, these are not mutually exclusive categories, but just some of the kinds of pollution that's taking place. We've got organic pollution, and this is something we sometimes forget about. I mean, the greatest probably quantity of pollution as such comes from human waste, animal waste, and crop residues, all kinds of agricultural waste. It's not any evil chemicals that our industry is cooking up for us and putting in our water supply. It's simply things that have always been around, but there are just so many of us now that it becomes a greater and greater problem. And of course, as sanitation, getting rid of human waste in a safe way has been a problem that people have looked at for hundreds of years. And in this international decade I told you about at the beginning, where we're talking about clean water for all, one of the very important aspects is adequate sanitation for all, because it's so important. Some of the most toxic things that can be in our water supply are as a result of human waste. So obviously there's organic and then there's inorganic. So those are just two categories that you can think about. Inorganic, the most dangerous things are the toxic chemicals, pesticides, all kinds of things produced by industry especially. And then other points that you might not have thought of is that some of our pollution comes from point sources. Sorry, I'm really terrible today. Point sources are, of course, things like sewers, where it goes right into the river, where it comes out of your water treatment plant and goes into the river if it's not adequately treated. Where it comes out of factories and goes into the river. You know where that is. And it's very easy for the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, to monitor the quality of that water that's coming out of one point and going into the water. I think in the 60s, this was our major kind of pollution. You know, when the stories of pollution were like the river that caught on fire and things like that. I mean, terrible kinds of pollution were going directly into the water. But those are easy to regulate, and things have improved a lot since the 60s. It's still not adequate, but things have improved. So now people are talking more and more about what's called non-point source pollution. I think it's people have woken up to the fact that most of our, or a great deal of pollution is coming from not one area where you can monitor, but the runoff for everywhere from our modern agriculture, from livestock raising areas where there's huge quantities of manure that produce nitrates, and whether pesticide runoff from golf courses or anything else that go into our rivers all the way along and also go directly into our groundwater. So 65% of our pollution of groundwater, according to one report that I read, comes from non-point source pollution. Just so that you have in your head what's really contaminating our water. We know, and some of the most visible pollution is what goes into the surface water. If you see a pipe leading out of dirty water into a river, you see it. Rubbish that's washed up onto beaches, we see, and people are horrified by that. Oil that covers Prince William Sound in Alaska, people see and speak out. You can photograph it, you can put it on TV, you can put it in magazines, and people will be shocked and demand that something be done about it. But what at least I really worry about the most is the pollution that's going right into the groundwater. We never see it. So unless you're kind of intellectually aware enough to know that it's happening and be concerned about it, you won't necessarily jump on the bandwagon to stop groundwater pollution. We have been alerted to the toxic waste dumps, especially of years past, how much toxic waste is being leached into our groundwater supplies. Once in a while this hits headlines. Remember the Love Canal disaster? Can't remember, was that in the 60s, maybe the 70s?
It's been 10 years or more, hasn't it?
I think it's been 20 some years. But when, when thousands of people had to move out of their homes.
They're now selling the homes again.
Yeah, so we hope that means it's cleaned up. We don't have any data to go on except what people see. So we hope that they're going back with good reason. It's hard.
The prices are reasonable.
Sure they are. That's a good point. And so I think this is really what we need to be considering about. Another kind of water pollution, which we don't always think about, is as water pollution. I think of it as air pollution, but as I pointed out, our waters are being contaminated through the acid rain.
Sure.
As you know, it comes as a result of air pollution, of things that we're burning in our smokestacks, mm-hmm. but it's contaminating our water supply. Okay, I bring these up as, like our forum tonight, and we're going to talk about what to be most concerned of in a world of problems. Well, there's all kinds of pollution to be concerned of, and what should we be most concerned of? It's hard to know. The organic waste on the top, we have been treating for a long, long time by sedimentation and through different kinds of microbes that speed up the natural process of breaking them down. The inorganic waste, we haven't really perfected any treatments, especially things like heavy metals that get in. Really, we don't know how to take those out. There are places where we have very good treatment systems, but a catastrophe happens. Remember the Sandoz factory in Switzerland a few years back where there's a chemical plant along the Rhine River, and there was a fire. I think that their treatment of their waste was fine. They weren't dumping into the water regularly amounts of pollution. But this fire happened, and it was just catastrophic all the way along the Rhine River. Cities were forced to stop their intakes for their water treatment. And those kind of things can happen. So I guess the main thing that all the experts agree on is the treatment is extremely expensive. We really don't know how to treat very well, and even if we do, it's very expensive. And what we need to do is prevent contamination. Industries are learning slowly as environmental regulations force them to have the water that they put into streams up to a certain level of cleanliness. They're learning to recycle it themselves, use it several times. Things are a lot better than they were before the regulations got strict. And that's the line along which we need to continue to move. We need to integrate our water management more in all means. Soil erosion control is an important part of water control. So we work with our farmers. Stopping deforestation is another part of it. It really has an effect on water supply. Sanitation measures need to be improved. And one of the problems internationally, and I think in every country of the world, is that often people that work on soil erosion are not the same people, not the same offices that work on reforestation, and it would be a whole different ministry that would work on and sanitation. So we need to figure out ways to work better between disciplines to solve these water problems. And the other thing, as I talked especially at the beginning, is that we need to work between nations, which is one of the most difficult things mm-hmm. for us to do. The globe is so small now, the world is so small, that even if we enact every water pollution control measure possible, and all our water is pristine and clear, we cannot be guaranteed good water if the other countries in the world are polluting it. We need to all work together. So,
I'm going to make a comment on point source. I know the intent you put to it, but you know, you think about it, each of our own homes is a kind of a point source, because there has been sort of a general attitude, you don't want something liquid, what do? You put it down the drain. And I think people are just now becoming more aware that there are so many things that have no business going down the drain. And many cities have at least a once a year collection of these things, used paints and things that aren't, you don't really think of as harmful, but in the water they should never be. So that's something that, you know, we can all do starting tomorrow.
Thank you. That's really true. We tend so much to think of industries and how they're polluting, but anytime we put something toxic in the drain, it certainly is going to go into the water supply, because most sewage disposal things cannot remove.
Medicines don't belong in the drain.
You know, I've read someplace, you know, they say that a lot of the excess fertilizer and everything and bug killers that are put on the ground and contaminating the groundwater are actually happening in the cities with these companies that go around and spray your lawns.
Yeah.
But it's greater than what happens out in the country.
I doubt if it's greater, but it's certainly something to think about.
They claim that more of it is polluting the water than anything. They spray 4 times a year and fertilize 4 times a year. A lot of it is when it's not practical and it's not used, and what it does is just goes right straight through. All they do is get money out of it.
Yeah.
And there's no, as far as I can see, there is no control over what they do and to show that it's effective and needed.
Thank you for pointing that out. And that is really something that we can all be aware of, not using unnecessary pesticides on our own lawns.
You know, in Florida, they spray the lawns and the men come in looking like men from Mars. They're absolutely covered because they...
Gives you an idea of how toxic those chemicals are.
Toxic. They can't touch it themselves.
They're using DDT.
Okay, we had one hand back there and then you over here.
Yes, over in the little store, there are some great books right there on the counter. 50 mm-hmm. ways to... I don't know what the rest of the title of the book is, but there's something for adults and something for children. There's two different books. And they're wonderful. It's covering all of these things that you're covering now and more.
Thank you.
And one book is $4.95 and the other one is $6.95.
Good. Thank you.
I just wanted to say that in the great state of Iowa, where I'm from, that even our state capital University City of Iowa City have come out and warned anyone who is pregnant or anyone who has infants not to use the water because the nitrate level is above the danger.
No!
Right now.
Yes, yes,
right
it's been in the paper.
You carry your water or something.
Just out of curiosity, how many people here buy bottled water? Well, that's at your office. That's very interesting to me, and I don't know what to think. Currently, they say it's a $2 billion industry per year. People buy bottled water. That's my question. That's why I can't see a point in it. Right.
But
what's the know about your water?
I buy distilled water. Not
you buy distilled?
Yes, not the regular pure.
Okay, now are we guaranteed that that's pure?
That's what I'd like to know.
It's not made for drinking. I think that we need some of the minerals. I mean, the natural minerals in water are not harmful, but that's an interesting thought.
I think you get enough of them through eating a balanced meal if you eat vegetables and fruits.
Okay, that's a thought.
Mm-hmm. We buy bottled water when we're in Texas because we live 10 miles from the Rio Grande River down there for 3 months of the year. And we read that the incidence of cancer is higher in the Rio Grande Valley because of the water. And that people should be very, very alert not to drink any tap water in Texas and along the Rio Grande River.
Well, I think that's very responsible to pay attention to what's being tested in your particular water. I mean, most tap water in the United States is fit to drink now, by far the majority. Although the National Wildlife, what did I just write down? The National Wildlife Federation reports, and I don't know if this is a really credible organization, it's hard for me to say. They reported 100,000 violations of federal drinking water regulations in 1988 across the U.S., which affects 38 million people. So that's what, a little fifth, maybe a sixth of people in the U.S. supposedly have water that does not meet federal standards. But that means five-sixths of us do. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I used to work for a private food and water testing lab, and a lot of people would always ask me the question about bottled water. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that testing is very expensive for anyone who does buy bottled water. I would say keep challenging your representative. The person who's selling you the system, say, I want proof, I want data. Make these people test their water. Make them show you your results. And make them prove that it's good. Because they can say, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
But there's a lot of them where they're not getting out pesticide residues. And they're filtering through systems that, as a chemist, I'd say, no way are we getting out of stuff to
the Culligan man.
And one thing I'd say for sure is a lot of people like spring water. It sounds nice. That is the last thing I'd ever buy. If it's from a spring, that means it's very close to the surface. And if anything, and if water's going into any aquifer, it's going into that aquifer. That's how it seems to me, anyway. It's the closest there is. I'd rather have some water
There's
come up
barrier,
from
right?
1,000 feet. So that's, I don't know.
One short comment. You've been talking about aquifers. The state of Iowa has a law ruling through the National Department of Natural Resources that you cannot dig a well in the state of Iowa without permission. Mm. And when you ask for permission, there is a whole series of questions that you have to prove as to why you need the water, what you're going to use it for, the amount of water, etc. And they are very, very strict in maintaining this law.
Good.
You know, you said something about the Midwest not needing water. Southern tier of states in central Iowa 2 years ago had to have water trucked in because there was no water.
There was no water, or was it a bad quality?
There was
quality?
No water.
Drought.
Really?
Drought.
Because of the drought. Yeah.
Southern drought Iowa. Okay, Southern. I'm thinking of
maybe. It was in the center, yes. They trucked a lot of it in. I think they finally put a pipeline down from the Des Moines area. They've got a pipeline from the Des Moines area.
Where had they gotten water before? From groundwater and that dried up?
Where they got it.
Wells
it was just
dry.
So dry. The wells all went dry.
Well, there you are.
Yeah.
Drought situation 2 years ago was just unbelievable.
Yeah, and it wasn't until this spring that around the Quad Cities that the subsoil became last year the subsoil was dry if you went down this far. I know I went out and plant something and I got a few inches below the ground and it was just like powder.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned
other people, let me see, you've told you. Yes.
You said the ocean has all the water it needs. Have they ever been able practically to remove salt from the water and make it usable?
It's expensive.
Yeah. It seems that the country of Bahrain, which everybody knows that, it's one of those, on the Arab Peninsula. The only people that are doing it a lot are on the Arab Peninsula, and especially Bahrain, it seems, is getting much of its water from that. But they are the ones who have plenty of energy. The main problem is it's very expensive because it's very energy intensive. You can do it by solar, but it very small quantities of water. I mean, we built once a solar distiller that was probably, I don't know, 10 feet by 10 feet or something like that, and it came out with maybe a quart a day. I mean, that's not like going to get you very far. So it's possible with solar, but not enough water. And anything else uses too much fuel. But the technology is there, but it's not likely to supply us in any great...
It'll come, I think, in the future.
It's one of the more expensive possible ways. We're a lot better off if we protect our fresh water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Much, much better off.
We'd have made fuel to burn by then.
In Illinois, they have a law that says that if, when they test your water, you know, that city, and if it's not up to standard, a notification has to be sent out with the bill every month. Every time you send out the water bill, a notification is sent out with this. And the city where I live in, no kidding, for a year and a half, the notification was there. You know, it's subject to certain whatever. I can't remember what was wrong with the water. And I continued to drink the water because I didn't know what was in the water that was in the bottled water either. And anyway, they have now made some changes. and the water's acceptable, and there's no longer any cancer warning, carcinogenic warnings along with the bill.
Boy, that would wake up a lot of people.
Yeah.
Do you want to make another comment?
Time.
It'll probably be the last one. Thank you.
You mentioned when you started, you know, the value of water is becoming known. I wanted to mention in our part of the country, where there is the Columbia Basin Irrigation Project. About 10 or 15 years ago, the big farming companies were coming in and putting in, and it did cost them a lot, big pumping systems into the reservoir behind the dam. But what they wanted to get politically was perpetual water rights. And that was a big fight to get that cut down to, I think it ended up as 50 years, not forever. Because you can see what might happen with a perpetual
dry.
Well, who knows what the value of water may be 100 years from now, or the need.
And also, I suppose they don't pay for the water; they simply pay their own.
They do pay, but you would hate to have one individual, because he spent this money now, have the right to take it forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, good. I'm really glad to hear your comments. It shows, I mean, clearly this is an issue that we all know affects us. This is nothing new, and I think a lot of people have offered really helpful information. And also, I appreciate all the solutions, the suggestions for how we can work in our own lives to change this. So, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.